Think about the imagery we usually associate with a modern global navy. It's almost always high adrenaline stuff.
Right, supersonic fighter jets, destroyers cutting through the waves.
Exactly. Submarines slipping under the surface. But the reality of projecting military power across the globe isn't just about sleek, high-tech weapons.
No, it really isn't.
It is mostly about the incredibly unglamorous, dirty, and exhausting logistics required to keep those machines running.
It's the ultimate truth of military strategy, really. You know the saying, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. And if you want to understand the scale of what is happening in the world's oceans right now, you absolutely have to look at the supply lines. We are witnessing one of the most rapid maritime transformations in modern history.
And that transformation is our mission for this deep dive. We're taking a stack of freshly translated Chinese military documents, maritime reports, and strategic analyses to really unpack China's rise as a blue water maritime power.
Yeah, we've got a lot of fascinating source material today.
We do. Because whether you analyze Indo-Pacific policy for a living, or you're just trying to understand the changing global order, it is so easy to get lost in the jargon of military
Well,
acronyms.
for sure. It's alphabet soup.
So we're going to cut through all that noise for you. We're going to look at the physical hardware they're building, the very human struggle to staff those ships, and how this newly minted fleet is actually being deployed.
And importantly, we're going to look at how they are interpreting U.S. strategy in the region. Because, I mean, you really can't grasp the physical maneuvers on the water without understanding the cognitive blueprints that ordered them into action.
Right. So let's rewind a bit to the strategic shift that kicked this all off. Because to understand the ships, you have to understand the commander's vision. Back in 2012, Xi Jinping took the helm of the People's Liberation Army Navy, the PLAN, and he laid out a very clear doctrine.
Yeah, declaring that strong countries are strong at sea. And that marked a fundamental pivot. Historically, China maintained a relatively conciliatory approach to its maritime boundaries. Their military focus was overwhelmingly continental.
Like protecting their massive land borders.
Right. But between 2014 and 2017, there was a complete rewiring of their military strategy and command structure. The posture shifted aggressively toward defending maritime rights and protecting their expanding overseas interests.
Which means they elevated the Navy's status to operate way beyond their home shores.
Exactly. But operating far from home brings us right back to logistics. You cannot be a true blue water navy, meaning operating globally across deep oceans, if you can't refuel in the middle of nowhere.
And this is where those translated articles from the Chinese magazine Shipborne Weapons get incredibly concrete. They outline plans for China's next generation aircraft carrier supply ships, the successors to their current Type 901.
And the sheer scale of these new vessels is just difficult to wrap your head around. We're looking at an expected jump to a 55,000-ton displacement and 255 meters in length.
Wait, 55,000 tons? Just to visualize that for you listening, that is roughly the weight of the Titanic.
Yeah, it's massive.
But instead of luxury cabins, it's entirely dedicated to hauling fuel, ammunition, and food.
It is a massive logistical footprint designed specifically to sustain their new conventionally powered supercarriers, like the Fujian.
Right.
And there is a fascinating tactical shift buried in these design specs. The documents indicate they are likely abandoning heavy fuel oil for these supply ships and switching the propulsion entirely to light diesel.
I was actually puzzling over that. Because heavy fuel oil, the sludgy stuff most cargo ships run on, is significantly cheaper. It seems counterintuitive to switch to more expensive fuel when you are operating on this massive scale.
It does seem weird at first glance.
But thinking through the mechanics of it has to be about standardizing the fleet, right?
That's the core of it, yeah. The strategic payoff of fuel standardization far outweighs the financial cost. If you run your massive supply ship on the same light diesel that powers your aircraft carrier and your destroyers, then a single next-generation supply ship can carry over 23,000 tons of that standardized fuel.
It essentially becomes a universal floating gas station.
It really does. It can pump fuel into the aircraft carrier, refuel the escorts, and power its own engines, all from the exact same tanks. It completely eliminates the logistical nightmare of carrying different grades of fuel.
Which simplifies the plumbing and the mid-ocean transfer process. I've been thinking about this using an Amazon logistics network analogy.
Okay, I like that.
People tend to focus on the shiny delivery van pulling up to their house. In this case, the aircraft carrier launching fighter jets. But that van is useless without the unglamorous, massive distribution centers behind it.
Right, the warehouses.
Yeah. These 55,000-ton replenishment ships are essentially mobile distribution centers.
And taking that analogy a step further, China is also building a second line force of commercial standard ships. Their entire job is to resupply the primary supply ships in safe zones.
So it's a supply chain for the supply chain.
Exactly. So the main heavily armed logistics vessels never have to leave the carrier strike group to go all the way back to port because, you know, they're carrying so much critical fuel, they are incredibly high value targets.
Which explains the engines and the weapon systems detailed in the reports. To push a 55,000-ton warehouse through the ocean and keep up with a carrier doing 25-plus knots, the sources point to them using four CGT-25 gas turbines.
That's about 100,000 horsepower.
Yeah, but they aren't just fast. They are arming these things to the teeth for a supply ship.
They really are. They're outfitting them with formidable self-defense suites, specifically the HQ-10 short-range air defense missile launcher and the Type 1130 close-in weapon system.
And for those unfamiliar, a close-in weapon system, or CIWS, is essentially a mechanical goalkeeper. It's an 11-barrel Gatling gun guided by radar that shoots thousands of rounds a minute.
It's intense.
It's the absolute last line of defense designed to physically shred an incoming anti-ship missile just seconds before it hits the hull.
And equipping a supply ship with that level of autonomous defense shows they anticipate operating in highly contested environments.
Right.
Plus, we're already seeing their new joint command structure operating seamlessly. The PLA Army is now deploying troops overseas using Navy amphibious ships, like the Type 071 and 075.
Which proves the Army and Navy are actually communicating and operating as a single unit, which is historically a massive bureaucratic hurdle.
Oh, absolutely.
But as impressive as this physical hardware is, the documents reveal a glaring vulnerability. You can weld together all the super ships you want, but they are floating paperweights without highly trained personnel to operate them.
Yeah, and this brings us to the human bottleneck. The PLA is battling a massive software upgrade, and the software is the crew.
Right, because the demands of a modern warship are intensely technical.
Yeah.
You need people who can maintain quantum communication arrays, troubleshoot complex radar, and manage those massive gas turbines.
And the PLA has shifted away from simply putting up recruitment posters in rural towns to what they call precision recruitment.
Okay, what does that look like?
Well, they are desperately seeking high-quality candidates, specifically unmarried STEM graduates under the age of 24 or 26 for postgrads. They are also utilizing vocational colleges for targeted training of technical sergeants.
But the reality on the ground or in the recruiting office is that they are hitting a wall. The sources outline severe recruitment bottlenecks, and the mechanism they are using to solve it is fascinating.
Yeah, it's wild.
They have tied conscription quotas to the performance appraisals of local officials.
It creates this bizarre bureaucratic dynamic. You have local mayors and city administrators who are already overburdened trying to manage like municipal infrastructure.
Right, fixing potholes.
Exactly. And now they're being forced to act as military recruiters to hit specific quotas or else their own careers suffer.
And they are facing real pushback from universities combined with generally low physical fitness among the applicant pool. But I want to pull a thread on this strategy.
Sure.
If you have to force a local bureaucrat to recruit for you by threatening their job review, that feels like a glaring symptom of vulnerability. Doesn't that suggest that the baseline market, incentives, the pay, the quality of life, simply aren't enough to attract high-tech talent?
Oh, without a doubt. In a rapidly modernizing economy, the military is in direct competition with the private sector for top-tier STEM talent.
Makes sense.
A software engineer can make significantly more money with a much higher quality of life working at a tech firm in Shenzhen than they can sweating in the engine room of a destroyer for months at a time.
It's the classic problem of a booming private sector hollowing out public service talent.
And to compensate for this shortfall, the PLA is leaning heavily on patriotic national defense education. They are setting up conscription stations inside places like the Navy Museum in Qingdao.
Trying to catch potential recruits when they are immersed in naval glory.
Exactly. They are also creating joint military-civil emergency support systems to mobilize resources rapidly. The reliance on administrative pressure and patriotism really suggests their market-based incentives haven't caught up to the technical demands of the new fleet.
It's a profound bug in their modernization program. So we have the massive ships, and we have this frantic scramble to staff them. How is this newly acquired maritime power actually being applied on the water today? Let's look at operations east of Taiwan.
Yeah, this is where we see the transition from theoretical capability to applied pressure. Historically, when the China Coast Guard operated in the waters east of Taiwan, their presence was brief and episodic.
Like the Cutter Beta doing simulated boarding drills back in May 2024.
Right, but they left right after. It was just a temporary signal of political dissatisfaction.
But the maritime reports show that in early June 2026, the strategy fundamentally changed. And this was ostensibly a response to a joint statement by Japan and the Philippines about resolving their overlapping maritime boundaries.
Right. Beijing viewed that diplomatic statement as an infringement on its claimed maritime rights, mostly because those economic zones overlap with waters China claims around Taiwan.
So in response, China didn't just conduct a drill. They established a continuous, permanent presence east of Taiwan.
They sent out the 5,000-ton Daishan and the 3,000-ton Beta, and instead of doing a drill and going home, they just dropped anchor, so to speak.
And when they finally rotated out on July 4th, they were immediately relieved by two other cutters. It's a new normal. It's a bit like a squatter's rights situation.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Like adverse possession. Mm. If someone sets up a toll booth on a public road and no one physically dismantles it or legally forces them to leave, eventually people just accept that they control the road.
That is the foundational logic of gray zone operations. By establishing this permanent presence, China is changing the facts on the water without firing a single shot.
And this permanent Coast Guard presence is like a multi-tool, right?
Very much so. They can use these ships to escort PRC survey vessels, which are out there right now gathering vital undersea topographical data for future submarine operations.
But the far more concerning application for Taiwan is that this permanent presence allows the Coast Guard to instantly transition into quarantine operations. And just to clarify for you listening, a quarantine is different from a military blockade.
Very different. A military blockade is an act of war. A quarantine operates under the guise of maritime law enforcement.
So the Coast Guard uses the pretext of customs inspections to stop, board, and search commercial vessels heading to Taiwan.
Exactly. It paralyzes shipping lanes and puts immense constant pressure on Taipei's economy, as well as on Japan and the Philippines.
It forces the defending nations into an agonizing strategic bind. Like, do you escalate militarily by sending a Navy destroyer to confront a Coast Guard vessel?
Which looks like a massive overreaction on the global stage.
Right. Or do you do nothing and effectively cede administrative control of those waters?
It is a deliberate dilemma. And as China pushes its physical boundaries outward using these tactics, they are intensely studying how the U.S. military is pushing back.
Which brings us to the cognitive battlefield and how Chinese military analysts view U.S. strategy. And I want to be incredibly clear with you as we dive into this section, we are unpacking how Chinese military literature analyzes this situation.
We are absolutely not endorsing or validating these claims.
Right. But if you want to understand the geopolitical chessboard, you have to look at the board from the other player's perspective.
Empathy and intelligence doesn't mean agreement. It means understanding the adversary's framework. And the translated articles from the PLA's Navy Today magazine give us a fascinating look into their perspective on wargaming.
Yeah, they trace the history of wargaming back to ancient Chinese philosophers like Mozi and Lu Ban.
The story there is amazing.
It really is. I actually looked it up because it's so fascinating. The legend goes that Lu Ban had invented a new siege ladder for the King of Shu.
Right, to attack the state of Song.
Exactly. So Mozi wanted to stop the war, so he challenged Lu Ban to a war game right in front of the king. They used a belt to represent the city wall and small wooden tablets to represent the troops and siege weapons.
Oh, wow.
And Muzi successfully simulated the defense against all nine of Lu Ban's attack strategies, proving the invasion would fail and actually convinced the king to call off the war.
It's an incredible historical anchor for them. And the Chinese articles contrast that ancient philosophical approach to conflict resolution with the modern U.S. Pentagon, which relies on supercomputers and Monte Carlo algorithms.
And Monte Carlo algorithms, for anyone who hasn't taken statistics recently, are essentially a way of predicting the probability of different outcomes by running millions of randomized simulations.
Right.
It's like rolling a massive handful of dice over and over again to see all the possible ways a battle could play out. But Chinese analysts don't view U.S. wargaming as an objective mathematical tool.
Not at all. They claim that U.S. wargaming has degenerated into what they call strategic deception.
Okay, how so?
They view these highly publicized U.S. wargames, specifically the ones simulating conflicts over Taiwan, as cognitive weapons. In their view, the U.S. deliberately manipulates the parameters of these simulations to manufacture a specific result, usually a costly but decisive U.S. victory, and then leaks that narrative to the media.
So they view the war games essentially as marketing material for anxiety.
Pretty much.
They argue the U.S. uses these simulations to hold allies hostage, manipulate public opinion, and justify massive defense budgets. The documents specifically cite how U.S. war games have been used to push Japan to militarize its southwestern islands.
And to counter this, Chinese literature advocates for breaking what they call U.S. quantum hegemony and algorithmic monopolies.
Meaning what, practically?
They are essentially calling for international audits of U.S. simulation data to expose what they view as lies cloaked in data. They want to challenge the computing power that allows the U.S. to dominate the strategic narrative.
It is a wild psychological mirror effect when you step back and look at it. On one hand, China is actively creating a physical new normal in the gray zone east of Taiwan, literally leaving their ships in disputed waters to physically change reality on the ground.
Right.
But simultaneously, they're accusing the U.S. of using virtual war games as a cognitive weapon to manipulate geopolitical reality in the minds of allies.
It's a battle over who gets to define reality both on the physical water and in the virtual data.
It is a profound duality. Oh. And while they are critiquing the cognitive aspect of U.S. strategy, they are also deeply analyzing the physical tactical shifts of the U.S. military.
Right, definitely. The sources show the PLA is intensely studying the U.S. Marine Corps concept of stand-in forces, or SIF.
To understand stand-in forces, we first have to understand the obstacle they're trying to overcome. For years, China has built up this massive capability called anti-accessory denial.
Often referred to as the A2AD bubble.
Yes. Think of it as a massive overlapping web of long-range anti-ship and anti-air missiles designed to keep large U.S. aircraft carriers and bases as far away from China's shores as possible.
And the U.S. Marine Corps stand-in forces concept is designed specifically to puncture that defensive bubble.
By getting inside it.
Exactly. Instead of massing large vulnerable forces outside the missile zone and trying to fight their way in, the U.S. plans to distribute small, highly mobile, and often unmanned platforms directly inside the weapons engagement zone.
So operating right under China's nose,
yeah.
Maintaining a constant, persistent forward presence.
Yeah. Chinese analysts recognize that these stand-in forces are meant to establish a continuous surveillance net during peacetime. They'd utilize hydroacoustic arrays and drones to track Chinese submarines constantly.
And in the event of a conflict.
These small dispersed units would act as the leading edge enablers. They acquire targets and cue long-range strikes before the larger Chinese military machine can fully mobilize.
It's an incredibly adaptive strategy. Instead of trying to break down a fortress door with a massive, obvious battering ram, you slip 100 tiny invisible sensors through the cracks in the wall.
Great analogy. And the PLA is acutely aware that the U.S. is shifting from a standoff posture to this persistent interior lines contact layer, and they're scrambling to prepare their own counter responses.
They realize their own near seas might not be as secure as they hoped.
It forces the PLA to recognize that the era of an uncontested logistical buildup is over. They're building a massive machine, but they're building it in an environment that is actively adapting to counter them.
Which brings us to the core of what we've uncovered today. We started by looking at the staggering physical scale of China's ambition. They're building 55,000-ton supply ships capable of carrying 23,000 tons of standardized fuel just to project power globally.
Right, the logistics of empire.
We looked at the human bottleneck, the very real struggle to find the technical STEM talent to run these floating cities, and the heavy reliance on pressured local bureaucrats to hit quotas.
And we examined how that power is actually being applied, with Coast Guard ships establishing a permanent, suffocating new normal east of Taiwan, laying the groundwork for potential quarantine operations.
And finally, we explored the cognitive battlefield, the Chinese view of U.S. wargaming as a weapon of strategic deception, and their intense focus on countering U.S. Marine Corps stand-in forces operating inside their missile bubbles.
It is a highly complex, historically rooted system designed to achieve national rejuvenation through maritime dominance.
But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've talked about the impressive logistics, the aggressive recruitment drives, and the high-level strategic maneuvering.
Yeah.
But there is an ultimate hovering unknown over all of this. None of this modern, massive PLA machinery has ever been tested in a high-intensity, peer-to-peer conflict.
It is the ultimate variable in all of these calculations.
Get back to that Amazon logistics network analogy. It looks perfect on a spreadsheet. The mobile warehouses are built, the standardized fuel is loaded, the delivery vans are ready.
But what happens to that immaculate system the first time a massive, unprecedented hurricane hits?
Exactly. The true test of Xi Jinping's Blue Water Navy isn't just whether they can weld the ships together or force a mayor to meet a recruitment quota.
No.
The true test is whether this vast, entirely untested, and highly complex system can actually hold together when the theory on the whiteboard meets the chaotic, friction-filled reality of actual combat. Until that day comes, it remains the most expensive, elaborate theory in the world.
A theory waiting to be tested by the storm.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.